Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to Paulistic Behind the Curtain. It is our weekly opportunity to bring you the worlds of Broadway and theater and the arts here in Chicago. And we got a good one for you to open this show. You may have heard of the musical Jekyll and Hyde. You probably know the story of Jekyll and Hyde. It's been around since the 1880s, but now it's being done by Kokandi Productions at the Chopin Theater. This is Broadway brought to you in an intimate environment. It was the most incredible experience I've had. We're going to talk about it with you. Let's get to it. Let me introduce some of the key players who are part of this production at the Chopin. Joining us, the director of the show, because I don't think this happens without you, Derek. So Derek Manbarem, who has just done so many incredible things from American Psycho, and I go on and on. And I got to tell you, and Derek, I see you at Steppenwolf. Your work is in so many different places. There's something happening with you. I mean, there was a time, let's go back some years, where if somebody said, oh, Derek is directing this show, oh, that's nice. Now, when I know that you're directing a show, I know that I'm in, and I'm being serious, for an incredible experience. You are doing things that are like humanly impossible to do. So congratulations on that.
Thank you very much.
Did you take on Jekyll and Hyde? Did you sort of say, this is not an easy show to do and we're going to do it?
Yes. Because because it's not. I think for myself and also for Kokandi as a company, you know, we wanted to try doing something a bit larger scale. It's certainly the largest orchestra we've ever worked with before. It's also our first time upstairs at the Chopin Theater, where we often produce down in the basement. So for a show like this that does kind of demand more in many ways, it seemed like the right fit.
And it were, how many seats in that upstairs? It's like about 100 seats?
130.
Okay, so 130 seats. You somehow have a full orchestra back there and working with this space, and the voices are unbelievable. Let's meet some of the voices. You can't have Jekyll and Hyde without Jekyll and Hyde. Fortunately, you have to have just one guy. And so David Moreland joins us, who plays those roles, that role in the show. David, I've seen you in a lot of work. You've done American Psycho, Cruel Intentions, a lot of work. And those are your Kokandi shows. So obviously, Kokandi likes what you do and gave you this really great role in terms of doing that. I've got some interesting trivia questions for you. And of course, Jekyll and Hyde has got some, I don't know whether to talk about them as one or two. I think it's one. But they've got some love interest there. And so we'll start with Emma Carew, played by Emily McCormick. You are kind of, I guess, supposed to be the real love interest, right, Emily?
I guess that's sort of true at the beginning.
You're marrying the guy.
Yeah.
Your family, I think, has some questions about it, but we're going to talk about what that's all like. But there actually is maybe a real true love interest that goes on here, and that is the role of Lucy Harris, played by Ava Lane Stovall. Ava, you, I think for people saw you before, they certainly saw you in Alice by Heart. And so you were amazing, but I'm viewing this as an incredible breakout role for you. Do you see it that way as well?
Oh, well, that's very nice. It's a privilege to do it. I feel very lucky to play the role. It's one of my favorite roles. It's been one of my favorite roles since I was like 8 years old when I watched a high school production of it on YouTube. And I fell in love with it then. So it's my first lead, you know, principal role in Chicago, and it feels great to be able to do it with all these incredible people.
You know, you'd think everybody would understand the story or knows the story of Jekyll and Hyde. As I said, it goes back to Robert Louis Stevenson's novella back in 1886, something like that. It became a Broadway show in 1990, right, Derek? I think I've got that right. But David, let me come to you, since you are Jekyll and Hyde. Tell our viewers and listeners, what is this story about? And why are you playing two guys?
It's very much like a gothic horror. It's some very, very early borderline science fiction wherein Dr. Henry Jekyll gets it into his head that he wants to essentially go through experiments and go through the science necessary in order to try and separate good and evil within the human body. Naturally, in the 1880s, they thought that was possible. So through a series of experiments, he finds a way to eventually experiment upon himself when those in authority around him deny him access to proper experimentation. So he experiments upon himself, unleashing a side of himself or an entirely separate entity altogether, known as Mr. Edward Hyde, who goes on a bit of a spree of revenge and just sort of animalistic just instinct across the city of London, and it sort of goes from there. Yeah.
And you know what's interesting is I imagine some people could expect sort of Jekyll changing into Hyde to be a, you know, in the movies, you know, a real transformation into a, this, for, you know, Dracula monster werewolf thing happening. But they don't do that for you. There's a lot of things that don't happen in this show that I want to ask you about. But essentially, you just make it happen with you, with your body and with your mannerisms and with your posture. And that's how we get the difference between Jekyll and Hyde. Now, Emily, your character falls in love, certainly with Dr. Jekyll, but he changes over time a little bit. So what, tell us a little bit about what Emma is going through with him. Because after a while, she's like, Henry, what the heck's going on with you?
Sure. So Emma is engaged to Dr. Jekyll at the beginning of the show. And really, we've talked about this a little bit in rehearsal. Like, we have like one scene, this engagement party, where it's like, we're happy and in love. And then every other time we interact is so like riddled with strife. it was fun to try and find that relationship in such a small period of time. And then the next time I see him, we're in the lab and it's like, there's very clearly something wrong with him. And so I think for me, it's really been about like this young woman and she has this idea of like, we're going to have this like beautiful love story. And as the show goes on, it kind of seems like that is slipping away.
I wonder why.
What could happen?
And Ava, let's talk about Lucy, because the truth is Lucy's a hard character when we first meet her to feel a lot of empathy for, because, well, her profession is one of the oldest in the world.
It's true. She is a lady of the night. I mean, I don't know if we're PG-13 or more here, but yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about Lucy is that she is like, in all terms of the word, facade kind of one of our opening numbers of the show is about how everyone kind of has this facade they put on, and her facade, it, like you said, kind of prevents you from feeling much empathy for her, maybe in the traditional sense. But I feel like you can't help but root for her as you watch the show, because we all know a Lucy Harris. We've all been Lucy Harris. I mean, she's a tragic figure in a lot of ways, and you're
we've all been people
more
of the night. We've
well, all been listen. I speak
hey,
for myself.
What you do in your own time.
But I think she yearns for love. She learns for freedom. She yearns for a lot of things that all of us yearn for, and it's hard not to root for her. Emma and her are interesting mirrors for each other in a lot of ways.
Derek, the music under the direction of Nick Sulla in this show, as I said, somehow you've got a 1,000-piece orchestra back there behind the wall. I don't know how you've done it, but talk a little bit about the music of the show. I, you know, for me, I was intrigued because I'm a big Leslie Bricus fan, because songs that I mentioned, Take Me As I Am, This Is the Moment, Someone Like You, unbelievable.
I do think one of the first goals we had when deciding to produce this show was making sure we were doing justice to the music, because for so many people, because this show is rarely produced, because it is such a huge show, I think the show lives for many fans as a cast recording, or as a bootleg that they've watched hundreds and hundreds of times. So it kind of felt like if we were going to do the show, it felt kind of all or nothing. And in some of the initial conversations with Nick presented, like, Nick Sulla, our incredible music director, was like, okay, so this is the version of the show with four musicians. This is what we would get if we went up to eight. This is what it is if it's 12. And if it's 12, we might as well just do the whole thing.
So we did. So I want to talk to you. I'm sorry to interrupt. Unfortunately, I've got to go to break. But there's so much more to talk about. Like, I want to ask David whether he really thinks there is an Edward Hyde, and lots of other questions. So we're going to go to break to do this. But let me encourage everybody, you do not want to miss, believe me, Jekyll and Hyde. It has been extended to January 10th at the Chopin Theater. Tickets at CocandyProductions.com. We'll put that on the website page as well. But guys, can you all stay on so we can talk some more? Because, yeah, the folks who watch this show on TV know that if they, on Monday morning, they can go on over to WGNradio.com and hear the bonus conversation, which takes us deeper into what this show is all about. All right, we are back with Behind the Curtain, and we're continuing our conversation with the director and principal cast members of Jekyll and Hyde over at the Chopin Theater. You can get tickets at CocandyProductions.com. Derek, let me pick up with you on the music, and you had mentioned that your musical director, Nick Sulla, sort of said, well, we could do the kids' version of it, or we can have the full orchestra. I actually thought there were 15 orchestra members. Are there
15? No, there are 15.
There are 15. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, and it sounds like 25. So just amazing. So what made you say, all right, small theater, 130 people, let's make it happen?
Well, yeah, it felt like we as a storefront company in Chicago could either do like one of two things. And the former is what we've done with a lot of shows, which is like, oh, this is what the really sort of like stripped down smaller orchestration, you know, like, one or two musicians, like we did Into the Woods with just two pianos. So that was like our way into that show musically. But for this one, it felt like there was no point in doing the show unless we could really do the full breadth of the music. Like, because even like taking one instrument out is like, oh, well, then we lose that in that song. Or if we went down a few musicians, oh, there goes the string quartet. And so, you know, part of it was just really embracing that we were going to go for it and do the full orchestrations. Because again, that's also the version that people are accustomed to hearing. Because I think for most people, like this show is a cast recording that they rarely get to see. And at some point I mentioned to the cast, getting to watch this show with people who so obviously have loved the music for so long is just such a gift. It reminds me of like what it must be like to like love a musical artist and finally get to see them in concert like 20 years later. Yeah. To just like see the songs coming to life in front of them for the first time is just such a joy to watch people sing along, mostly just mouthing along, but every now and then we do have audience members like actively sort of singing along with the cast, yeah, occasionally in the front row, which I know the cast loves.
Guilty. Well, and you know, each of you have, I mean, so many songs you talked about, Ava Facade and whatever. But of course, if you were to go to the average person who doesn't even know the show, but they knew music a little bit, each of you have a song that I think everybody knows. Take Me As I Am, one of Emma's songs. This Is the Moment for Jekyll, Someone Like You, Lucy. By the way, when Lucy does some of her numbers, do the rest of you just go to Starbucks for coffee because you realize that by the time the ovation is over, you might as well just go take a break and come back a half an hour later?
Truly what's happening is we're all standing backstage going, she's so good.
And you are too, by the way, you all are. That is, you know, that is with love to all of you. But yeah, Ava, your numbers, it's mouth dropping to watch that happen. David, I need Derek to set this question up for you. When Derek made the prop list and he posted it, I expected you might think, all right, we're going to have maybe 10 pages of a prop list. So we will all help. We'll all gather it. The prop list said table. End of prop list. David, I'm going to get your reaction to some of that, but Derek, was it a budget thing? We can't afford the. Or did you just go, you know what? This is just, these actors don't need props.
Yeah, I mean, a little bit of that. I have a very special relationship with props that they all laugh at me because I always try to figure out like what is the rule of the show, right? And it for me, oftentimes it's either kind of like all or nothing, and I often find that what is in an audience's imagination is going to be more satisfying to them than an actual prop. I don't know. Maybe it's also, I started out as an improviser where like object work is sort of the bread and, you know, like I could mix a cocktail right now if you wanted me to, but I don't know. It just felt like it didn't need it, with 12 performers this strong, like it just felt like the table was sort of essential as a thematic piece, both as like a, you know, a hospital table, but a laboratory table, but a, we also sort of use it as a bed sometimes. Like it felt good to have like a focal point there, but other than that, it really was just a conversation of do we need it? And more times than not, it felt like no.
So David, let me come to you. There's also one time, again, I was front row center. So there's a time when the table comes right down, literally over the footlights. And I thought, do they want me to get on there? I mean, is this an invitation? They've been hearing me sing. So perhaps this is my moment. But David, so you perform surgery. And I got to tell you, I'm watching you do what you're doing on there. And what Derek says is absolutely true. It's like, I know what you're doing. I mean, you don't need the sutures and the stitches, whenever it is you're supposed to use, because we see it. How do you as an actor prepare to do all the things you have to do as Dr. Jekyll without the stuff?
I mean, so much of it really comes from just doing my best to make it as realistic as possible, because it's just a matter of like falling down the rabbit hole of, well, if I'm going to use sutures for this, then like I'll probably want to like thread the needle and like use that. And it's following the logic train all the way back to try and not even like make it like overtly this is what I'm doing, everybody, but just to make it clear that like I'm doing something intentional. And I think that's more what it is, more so than the specific action that I'm doing. I think it's just more the fact that it's supposed to seem like I'm doing something very specific, whether or not an audience is going to know what it is or not.
Well, we do. So I can tell you that, being an audience member, that I did know what you were trying to portray there. Emily, they probably blew the costume budget with you, because you got wedding dresses and all sorts of other things. But let me ask you a little bit about, I mean, at least that has to help, right? I mean, having the costumes that you have has to help you sort of be who you need to be in the scene.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we have an incredible costume designer named Rachel Sidnewski, who has done things for CoCandy and lots of theaters around town. And it was just so exciting, like at the first rehearsal, to like see her like vision for the show. And like for me especially, I think it's been helpful because like I've noticed like all the cast is walking around in like these dark like blues and blacks and browns, and I'm in bright white and pink.
Well, Miss Red was over on the other side of the stage from you, but go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and it tells you exactly, who Emma is when you see her, you know who Lucy is when you see her. And I think those costumes have just added like another level. Like everything about this show just feels so, so grand, from the orchestra to the set, to the lights, everything. And the costumes have just been another beautiful addition to that.
Ava, your thoughts? Again, not having the props, but at least you get, you know, and you listen, you go through some violent scenes with you, and you know, different things that you've gone, your character has gone through. Is that an issue for you, or you just, you know, the audience is with you?
Oh yeah, I think the emotion doesn't lie in the object. The emotion lies in the action that is tied into the object. And you know, you're correct. There's a lot of intense moments in the show for my character without giving too much away. But I think it lies in, you know, I think David and I have developed a great relationship of trust through the characters and also through just being friends. I think the intimacy coordinator and violence choreographer, and obviously Derek and Brenda, the choreographer, everyone treated those moments with plenty of sensitivity and respect. And I think sometimes less being shown is more effective, and also the more impactful way to go about something like that.
Yeah. you know, Derek, one of the things that I kind of pay attention to, I love when I'm in a show, of watching the ensemble members, however you want to word it, or essentially the atmosphere of the show at the time, because everybody's supposed to be watching, you know, maybe Jekyll and Lucy having their moment. But, and I watch that too, but I also am taking in everybody else who, you know, who is around, because in a lot of shows, including Broadway, it's not that they're not in character, but they're just kind of there, not taking any attention. What I love about, and I'm assuming this is your direction, you're making sure that every one of those characters knows who they are at all times, and they are who they need to be at all times. Is that directed by you? Am I imagining that?
No, I think that's correct. But I will say, like, sometimes to a fault, I feel like I get so excited by like what the ensemble's doing sometimes that I have to check in with an Ava and an Emily and a David and be like, hey, I see you. But yeah, especially with a show like this, where we're kind of going no props and, you know, not a ton of costume changes and like body forward ensemble centric work just is my jam. And with a group like this, you know, having less people on stage more often, doing more, just to me, is just really, really, really satisfying. But in terms of the detail work you're talking about, I mean, part of that just came from really good, curious questions from the ensemble. You know, like even if it's not 100% rooted in realism, I do feel like we always managed to make sure we were on the same page in terms of, okay, like, in this scene, are we just texture? Are we an extension of Jekyll? Are we actually now an extension of Lucy? You know, so that they kind of just know what the point of view is. Mm-hmm. And that feels really in alignment for this show. And my sense is they're all having a really good time with it.
Yeah, and those people who you've established as couples in the show, I mean, it's just like I said, they're together even when the focus is not on them. They're just very aware that that's who they are.
Yeah, and some of it's...
the present in that way. So David, this is the setup for the question I want to ask you, the setup question, which is, what happens in you when Jekyll becomes Hyde? What is happening in your mind? Do you just go, time to become Hyde? Or what is happening to you as an actor to become Edward Hyde?
Fair question. So such a deep part of what I'm doing on stage, and I know Ava and I have talked about this before and a handful of other people, but so much of what I am doing is almost like exclusively just like physical. So much of the physicality kind of informs everything else, from the voice to the posture to just like the way he walks and everything. Like, I find that if I'm focused on the way that my body is feeling in how I'm like moving from one space to another, that everything else just kind of like falls into place after that. So that's kind of once I found like the physical and the vocal distinction between the two, everything else just really dominoed in into their respective spots.
And that was the setup question for this question. I'd like all of you to chime in, then we'll go for the answer to Derek. But the question, David, is there really an Edward Hyde?
Thought about this a lot, and I honestly don't know that we have time for like my full answer, but
we're off TV. You got an hour and a half, go ahead.
I like when certain degrees of science fiction are rooted in like theoretical ideas, and so in like with the original like novella and everything, I mean, realistically, I know so much of it seems like it's just like this far-fetched wild horror idea, but in reality, if we trace back like the very idea of just like psychiatric medication and everything, with the way that like that can alter people's brain chemistry and everything, like realistically, this is just theories and ideas of what happened with that 100 years ago. So do I think that there is an Edward Hyde? Like, do I think that there is a separate entity that comes in? No, not necessarily. Do I think that there are like things within Henry Jekyll's brain that are suppressed or even enhanced by this chemical concoction he creates? Yes, I do. Do I think that Henry Jekyll is Edward Hyde? Also, no. It's entirely like they do not exist without each other, but that does not mean that Henry Jekyll at his core is the monstrous Edward Hyde as well.
Interesting. And Emily, what is your thought? Because you fall in love with Henry, but there's Edward who shows up. I mean, what is Emily's view of this? Are there two people there?
Yeah, Emily could talk about this for hours. It's so interesting because I read the book before we started rehearsal. So it's been a minute, but I think, correct me if I'm wrong, anyone, but I think there's kind of the implication in the book that at least at first, Jekyll kind of he transforms purposefully and kind of uses this as to take away his inhibition so that he can do things that maybe he already had the impulses to do, but shame or societal pressure or whatever stopped him from doing those things. And so I think, and there is a lyric in the show where he says, "You'll never be able to separate Jekyll from Hyde." And I think that just comes back to this idea, like the good and the evil exists in every single one of us. And we put on the facade to pretend that the evil's not there. But I think really it just comes down to choice. And I think in our show, in this version, that choice is kind of taken away from him. So the evil comes out whether he wants it or not, you know? So
it's like
I
the
agree
werewolf,
with David.
Right? You can't control it anymore.
Yeah.
Ava, what do you think?
I completely agree. I think, and some of my favorite scene work to do in the show or moments in the show is actually the scene work between Lucy and Dr. Jekyll. You know, I think in the advertisement of the show, Emma is Jekyll's and Lucy is Hyde's, but the intersection between all of those people, and by that I mean three, when we're even though there's four, is really interesting. And I think, you know, would Hyde come after Lucy if Dr. Jekyll hadn't met Lucy first? I don't think so. So it makes you ask, what did Dr. Jekyll see in Lucy that then transferred over to Hyde?
All right. And Derek, the reason I said I'm going to come to you for an answer is because I actually have an academic answer to this. So part of this is, I guess, as a director, I want to hear what you say, and then I'll tell you where I'm going with it. But what is your answer? Is there a Jekyll and is there a Hyde?
Oh, goodness.
How did you direct it? I mean, as making the decisions you had to make, how did you deal with it? Did you deal with a Jekyll and a Hyde as separate people?
Yeah. So, that's a good way to talk about it, I think. Because mainly, I think what kind of felt important to me and to us and, in the last 30 seconds of the show changed between every preview, like, and just in terms of like what we were leaving the audience with, what we were trying to say, et cetera, et cetera. So the things I kind of knew, like right off the bat, like, is we didn't want to rely on a costume hair makeup change, because that just didn't seem like something sustainable that we could do. And then as David, mentioned, kind of developing the vocals and the physicality, like that was just so exciting to, kind of like hang the transformation on, in terms of just like, oh, like let it just be the person and then kind of figure out how people react to it. So is there a separate entity? I would say no. Is there a Hyde in all of us? For sure. And kind of like researching different ways the transformation has been done. There are all these like phenomenal video essays on YouTube of people who have dissected every version of this show. But the two that were most interesting to me that I sort of like brought to David in terms of like, do we want to run with one of these? Is there's the idea that, the only thing that changes between Jekyll and Hyde is physical appearance, that it really is just like altering his appearance so that he can then do whatever the heck he wants to do. Or it's the opposite, that like all that changes is the inside. Nothing changes physically, but because he really does unleash this inner monster, people see him differently, you know? So those are the sort of like two extremes. And I feel like maybe it's trying to have our cake and eat it too, but I don't know that we came down decisively, like as a production, on which of those is true, or if both are true. Both can be true.
Where I get this, and I can't take credit for it, was my partner that when we walked out, he had done his little homework on the show and stuff, and there is a documentary, like 20 minutes or something like that, and Google it, YouTube it, whatever. Folks watching us can do the same, and it's called "There Is No Edward Hyde." And it basically walks through from when Stevenson wrote the novella and all the movies and all the different ways it's been played with through the years. He goes on, the author of that documentary goes on to basically say people just didn't get it. What was originally in 1886 got lost through the years, whether it's because of the art of film. There's lots of reasons it happened. But in the end, it's what you said, Derek. It was kind of this psychological piece to basically say there is no Edward Hyde. It's all Jekyll. And it's who Jekyll either wants to be or you know, or takes over him, but it is one guy. And that brings in David's points that I think are useful, which is the, well, you know, add in the science and we can change things. But I think the idea of this documentary was, what was Stevenson thinking? And what was he intending 140 years ago or whatever it was that he was doing that?
Well, and that's the reveal at the end. I mean, the original story, the sort of like rug pull behind the curtain moment at the end of the original short story is that it's him. Like, we take it for granted now that Jekyll and Hyde are the same person, but like, that was sort of the twist originally, was like, oh my God, can you believe this is the same guy?
Yeah. You're all working in the upstairs theater at the Chopin, which is really great because it is a proscenium. And, you know, other than being a smaller theater, it's you're in kind of a regular theater. I'm saying that because David and Ava, you have the experience of working in Derek's other theater, where somehow he has to work around like things in the building, and it just posts and things that are just there. And Derek, like I said, that was what American Psycho. I'm going to go back to American Psycho. I mean, the way you just created, and I mean, all the reviews talked about how clever you were in creating the stage that you set, sort of making it fashion show like, if you will. And just, you have to work with what you have to work with. So, Derek, when you moved upstairs, well, I guess my question is, number one, did you say this needs to be upstairs? Or if we stuck you in the room with the posts, would you have dealt with it?
Yeah, I remember. I mean, we were Scott Kokindy, our executive producer and our namesake, and I were at the Chopin talking about the season that we're currently in. And I really remember it was like, oh no, we're going to stay in the basement this year. And then when we talked through the shows, it was like, hold on, let's maybe just like go take a look like at the upstairs space, because they have the availability. And I do think like the kind of deciding factor was, once we knew we were going to do the full orchestration, I mean, I don't know if you could tell in the way the upstairs space is set up, but the orchestra takes up as much space, if not slightly more, than our playing area.
Yeah, that's why in Amelie, you have to make half the cast orchestra players.
Yes, exactly. So really, like, that was one of the big deciding factors, was that we knew to have the space for the orchestra, we needed to move upstairs. But there's just so much, like, in the, you know, the gothic nature of the show, even though the design didn't end up going to, like, you know, like full, like, Victorian gothic exteriors or anything like that, it just felt like it wanted height. And it also wanted, the acoustics of that space, just to like really let the music soar. I've got a video of the first time the cast, when we were at Sitz Probe, the first time the orchestra played the overture, just the prologue music, just the cast being like, oh my God, just like it necessitated the space to do the show.
Well, it might've been good if, like, when Lucy gets to her big number, she pulls a cello out and she just, you know, makes it work.
Maybe for the
extension. I suggested it.
She tried. She insisted.
I'm always amazed when, you know, members of the cast all of a sudden, oh, plays the flute. that's actually going on now at Godspell over at Music Theater Works. So let me again ask our cast members, while the two of you have been in the downstairs space performing, Emily, I assume you have not, right? Because this is your first Candy. This is your first time within this world. So talk to me about the intimacy of playing in this space. Again, big show. It's one thing to do a show, I'll even say like an Amelie, which was just there because, you know, it's not this. You can be amongst the audience members for the way that show works, if that makes any sense. But David, because of everything you have to go through and everything you have to create, we are there with you. I was right there with you watching it. Is that a challenge for you as an actor? Or you're like, I don't care. Come along for the ride. I got a job to do.
To be completely honest, it depends on the show for me.
Let's talk about Jekyll and Hyde.
Sure. So for this specifically, I have a tendency to just sort of black the audience out. Just like, it's like, okay, and there, I'm just going to do my thing, pretend like they're not there, and cross my fingers and hope that they have a good time. So that's kind of my stance on it as for this one.
So that's why when I offered you potato chips during the rule, you weren't taking it from me.
I was right there. Like, come on, I'm doing something.
What are you giving me Fritos for? Emily and Brenda, your thoughts about just being so intimate. Well, I mean, let me ask you this question because I don't know. Have you been in this kind of intimate space before in the work that you've done?
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely done like smaller theaters before. I would say, I don't know. I agree with David. A lot of times it's kind of like I'm just doing my thing and I'm like, oh, there's an audience there. I look up and there are people looking at me. And I think that's what's been so special about this. I mean, like the different vibe of like Amelie seeing that was so amazing. Like they are making a connection with the, we're telling you this story and we are as well, but I think we're drawing them in a very different way. It's not as perhaps like presentational in nature. But you know, every person in this cast is absolutely incredible. And I think that the work that the ensemble is doing to like, we're like, come with us, bring us in. Like you kind of can't help but be zoned in. So it's, yeah, I love this space. And I think it's perfect for what we've built.
Ava, if you say you black the audience out, knowing that on some of your numbers, you're getting a standing ovation, I'm not going to buy it for 1 minute.
I was about to say, like, I feel bad for saying it, but it's hard to, but it's a blessing and a curse. I think for me personally, it was difficult to get used to. I've worked in intimate theaters before. I worked in the basement last summer, but this is different because it's a very exposed role in many ways. It's very vulnerable. It's very emotional. And to tap into that side of myself is, it can be intimidating to do in front of hundreds of people you don't know. But then you see the impact you're having on them and realize that they're that rooted in it as you are. And you see the tears, you see the applause, you see their eyes. And the most powerful moments of performing this show have come from the moments I'm right up against the front row and they almost have to avert their gaze. I think the intimacy does something magical for that. So
yeah, and you did take potato chips for me when I offered it up to you at that
well
moment.
I was hungry. It was right before my cello number and I just needed to get primed for
I the... like that. See how you weaved everything in, right?
It's storytelling. I've learned it from Derek.
Yes. I love it. Derek, congratulations. I mean, this is just such an accomplishment. And as I said at the beginning of this interview, it's like when I am watching a production that you are directing or creating, I'm sorry to say this, but I now have expectations of raised bars and increased accomplishments that unfortunately are going to follow you with everything you do from now on. Can you, by the way, can you tell us, are you working on something new? Is there something in the wind you can share?
Oh, good question. Also, thank you for that. That means a lot. Like, legit. Thank you. we're finalizing next season. I'm excited to say we'll be both upstairs and downstairs again for next season. Should likely have that announced. Probably.
Are you doing upstairs, downstairs, then using both parts at one time?
Could you imagine? There are shows that would be so perfect for that. we should have that announced in the next few weeks. So next season for Coke Candy, and then Nick Sula and I actually collaborate a lot at Roosevelt. So we're doing a university production of Natasha Pierre and the Great Comet in the spring. So that's the next thing. And then gearing up for Coke Candy stuff in the summer and fall.
Okay. You know, I collect a lot of theater props and all that sort of stuff. I have Lin-Manuel Miranda's original boots and stuff. So from Natasha Pierre, I actually have some of the original props and the Josh Groban thing. So let me know when you get there because I stole them. I might as well lend them to you.
just pay it forward.
Well, in that show, they actually allowed people to sit on stage, so I made sure I got one of those seats. Josh Groban did not need some of the things he was using, is all I'm saying.
unnecessary props. Unnecessary props.
Right. Lin-Manuel, you don't need that map. Give it over. Anyway, I want to encourage everybody to see Jekyll and Hyde at the Chopin Theater running through January 10th. Is that going to be a final, January 10th?
That's the that's the final. The puppets move in the day after.
Okay. Get tickets at CoCandyProductions.com. After all these years, by the way, I just got a Facebook connection with Scott CoCandy. I'm like, oh, wow, haven't we been here together for years? But apparently not. We are now.
Oh, wow.
I'm looking forward to that. So anyway, fabulous show, fabulous accomplishment. Thank you to all of you for spending time with me. This is just one of the best things I've seen, certainly this season. I'm not going to jinx it by talking about Jeffrey-type things, but but I will say that it would be well-deserved. So thanks to all of you, and thanks for spending the extra time with me here. I appreciate it. David, drive safely wherever you're going. Don't miss Jekyll and Hyde, and don't drink and drive. Don't miss Jekyll and Hyde through January 10th. GoCandyProductions.com. We'll see you next week on Behind the Curtain. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Paul.